A question of character. Aragorn's foot slipped out from under him as he stepped on a patch of slick mud, and he fell onto his side in the wet grass with brutal suddenness. He uttered a grunt and winced as his hip began to throb. The impact was sure to leave a bruise. "Bazul," he said, as he rolled to his feet and carefully stood. "At least I didn't land on Brisinger," he thought, as he pried scales of cold mud from his leggings. Feeling glum, he resumed trudging toward the ruined building where they had decided to camp, in the belief it would be safer than by the forest. As he strode through the grass, he startled a number of bullfrogs, who sprang out of hiding and fled, hopping to either side. The bullfrogs were the only other strange creature they had encountered on the island. Each had a horn-like projection above its reddish eyes, and from the center of its forehead sprouted a curving stalk, much like a fisherman's rod, upon the end of which hung a small, fleshy organ that at night glowed either white or yellow. The light allowed the bullfrogs to lure hundreds of flying insects within the reach of their tongues, and as a result of their easy access to food, the frogs grew enormously large. He had seen some the size of a bear's head, great fleshy lumps with staring eyes and mouths as wide as both his outstretched hands put together. The frogs reminded him of Angela the herbalist, and he suddenly wished that she were there on Vroengard Island with them. "If anyone could tell us our true names, I bet she could." For some reason, he always felt as if the herbalist could see right through him, as if she understood everything about him. It was a disconcerting sensation, but at the moment he would have welcomed it. He and Sephira had decided to trust Solombum and stay on Vroengard for another 3 days at most, while they tried to discover their true names. Glader had left the decision up to them. He said,
"You know Solombum better than I do. Stay or do not. Either way, the risk is great. There are no more safe paths."
It was Sephira who ultimately made the choice.
"The Weircats would never serve Galbatorix," she said. "They prize their freedom too highly. I would trust their word before that of any other creature, even an elf."
So they had stayed. They had spent the rest of that day, and now most of the next, sitting, thinking, talking, sharing memories, examining each other's minds, and trying various combinations of words in the ancient language, all in the hope that they would be able to either consciously work out their true names, or if they were lucky, strike upon them by accident. Glader had offered his help when asked, but for the most part he kept to himself, and gave Aragorn and Sephira privacy for their conversations, many of which Aragorn would have been embarrassed for anyone else to hear.
"The finding of one's true name ought to be something one does by oneself," said Glader. "If I think of either of yours, I will tell you, for we have no time to waste. But it would be better if you discover them on your own."
As of yet, neither of them had succeeded. Ever since Brom had explained to him about true names, Aragorn had wanted to learn his own. Knowledge, particularly self-knowledge, was ever a useful thing, and he hoped his true name would allow him to better master his thoughts and feelings. Still, he could not help but feel a certain amount of trepidation about what he might discover. Assuming that he could discover his name in the next few days, of which he was not entirely sure, he hoped he could, both for the success of their mission and because he did not want Glader or Sephira to figure it out for him. If he was to hear his whole being described in a word or phrase, then he wanted to arrive at that knowledge on his own, instead of having it thrust upon him. Aragorn sighed as he climbed the 5 broken steps that led up to the building. The structure had been a nesting house, or so Glader had said, and by the standards of Vroengard, it was so small as to be entirely unnoteworthy. Still, the walls were over 3 stories high, and the interior was large enough for Sephira to move about with ease. The southeastern corner had collapsed inward, taking part of the ceiling with it, but otherwise the building was sound. Aragorn's steps echoed as he walked through the vaulted entryway and made his way across the glassy floor of the main chamber. Embedded within the transparent material were swirling blades of colour that formed an abstract design of dizzying complexity. Every time he looked at it, he felt as if the lines were about to resolve into a recognisable shape, but they never did. The surface of the floor was covered with a fine web of cracks that radiated outward from the rubble beneath the gaping hole where the walls had given way. Long tendrils of ivy hung from the edges of the broken ceiling, like lengths of knotted rope. Water dripped from the ends of the vines to fall into shallow, misshapen puddles, and the sound of the droplets striking echoed throughout the building, a constant, irregular beat that Aragorn thought would drive him mad if he had to listen to it for more than a few days. Against the north-facing wall was a half-circle of stones Saphira had dragged and pushed into place to protect their camp. When he reached the barrier, Aragorn jumped onto the nearest block, which stood over 6 feet tall. Then he dropped down to the other side, landing heavily. Saphira paused in the midst of licking her forefoot, and he felt a questioning thought from her. He shook his head, and she returned to her grooming. Undoing his cloak, Aragorn walked over to the fire he had built close to the wall. He spread the sodden garment on the floor, then removed his mud-caked boots and set them out to dry as well.
"Does it look as if it will start raining again?"
Saphira asked. "Probably." He squatted by the fire for a bit, then sat on his bedroll and leaned against the wall. He watched Saphira as she worked her crimson tongue around the flexible cuticle at the base of each of her talons. An idea occurred to him, and he murmured a phrase in the ancient language. But to his disappointment, he felt no charge of energy in the words, nor did Saphira react to their utterance, as had Sloane when Aragorn had spoken his true name. Aragorn closed his eyes and tipped his head back. It frustrated him that he was unable to puzzle out Saphira's true name. He could accept that he did not fully understand himself, but he had known Saphira since the moment she had hatched, and he had shared nearly all of her memories. How could there be parts of her that were still a mystery to him? How could he have been better able to understand a murderer like Sloane than his own spell-bonded partner? Was it because she was a dragon and he was a human? Was it because Sloane's identity had been simpler than Saphira's? Aragorn did not know. One of the exercises he and Saphira had done, on Glaeda's recommendation, was to tell each other all of the flaws they had noticed, he in her and she in him. It had been a humbling exercise. Glaeda had also shared his observations, and though the dragon had been kind, Aragorn could not help but feel a sense of wounded pride upon hearing Glaeda list his various failings. And that, too, Aragorn knew he needed to take into account when trying to discover his true name. For Saphira, the hardest thing to come to terms with had been her vanity, which she had refused to acknowledge as such for the longest time. For Aragorn, it had been the arrogance Glaeda claimed he sometimes displayed, his feelings concerning the men he had killed, and all the petulance, selfishness, anger, and other shortcomings to which he, like so many others, was prey. And yet, though they had examined themselves as honestly as they could, their introspection had yielded no results. "Today and tomorrow, that's all we have." The thought of returning to the Varden empty-handed depressed him. "How are we supposed to best Calbatorix?" he wondered, as he had so many times before. "Another few days, and our lives may no longer be our own. We'll be slaves, like Murtagh and Thorn." He swore under his breath, and surreptitiously punched a fist against the floor.
"Be calm, Aragorn," said Glaeda, and
Aragorn noticed the dragon was shielding his thoughts so that Saphira did not hear.
"How can I?" he growled.
"It is easy to be calm when there is nothing to worry about, Aragorn. The true test of your self-control, however, is whether you can remain calm in a trying situation. You cannot allow anger or frustration to cloud your thoughts. Not at the moment. Right now, you need your mind to be clear.
Have you always been able to remain calm at times like this? The old dragon seemed to chuckle.
No. I used to growl and bite and knock down trees and tear up the ground. Once I broke the top of a mountain in the spine. The other dragons were rather upset with me for that. But I have had many years to learn that losing my temper rarely helps. You have not, I know. But allow my experience to guide you in this. Let go of your worries and focus only on the task at hand. The future will be what it will, and fretting about it will only make your fears more likely to come true.
I know, Aragorn sighed, but it's not easy.
Of course not. Few things of worth are.
Then Gleda withdrew and left him to the silence of his own mind. Aragorn fetched his bowl from the saddlebags, hopped over the half-circle of stones, and walked barefoot to one of the puddles underneath the opening in the ceiling. A light drizzle had begun to fall, coating that part of the floor with a slippery layer of water. He squatted by the edge of the puddle and began to scoop water into the bowl with his bare hands. Once the bowl was full, Aragorn retreated a few feet and set it on a piece of stone that was the height of a table. Then he fixed an image of Rohan in his mind and murmured, "Draumar Kopa." The water in the bowl shimmered, and an image of Rohan appeared against a pure white background. He was walking next to Horst and Albrecht. The three men looked tired and footsore, but they still carried weapons, so Aragorn knew the Empire had not captured them. He next scried Jormungandr, then Solumbum, who was tearing at a freshly killed robin, and then Arya, but Arya's wards hid her from his sight, and all he saw was blackness. At last Aragorn released the spell and tossed the water back into the puddle. As he climbed over the barrier surrounding their camp, Saphira stretched and yawned, arching her back like a cat, and said,
"How are they?"
"Safe, as far as I can tell." He dropped the bowl on the saddlebags, then lay on his bedroll, closed his eyes, and returned to scouring his mind for ideas as to what his true name might be. Every few minutes he thought of a different possibility, but none touched a chord within him, so he discarded them and began anew. All of the names contained a few constants. The fact that he was a rider, his affection for Saphira and Arya, his desire to vanquish Galbatorix, his relationships with Rohan, Garrow, and Brom, and the blood he shared with Murtagh. But no matter in what combination he placed those elements, the name did not speak to him. It was obvious that he was missing some crucial aspect of himself. So he kept making the names longer and longer, in the hope that he might stumble across whatever it was he was overlooking. When the names began to take him more than a minute to say, he realized he was wasting his time. He needed to re-examine his basic assumptions once again. He was convinced that his mistake lay in failing to notice some fault, or in not giving enough consideration to a fault he was already aware of. People, he had observed, were rarely willing to acknowledge their own imperfections, and he knew the same was true of himself. Somehow he had to cure himself of that blindness while he yet had time. It was a blindness born of pride and self-preservation, as it allowed him to believe the best of himself as he went about his life. However, he could no longer afford to indulge in such self-deception. Thus he thought and continued to think as the day wore on, but his efforts met only with failure. The rain grew heavier. Aragorn disliked the sound of it drumming against the puddles, for the featureless noise made it difficult to hear if anyone was trying to sneak up on them. Since their first night on Vroengard, he had seen no sign of the strange hooded figures whom he had watched wending their way through the city, nor had he felt any hint of their minds. Nevertheless, Aragorn remained conscious of their presence, and he could not help feeling that he and Saphira were about to be attacked at any moment. the grey light of day slowly faded to dusk, and a deep, starless night settled across the valley. Aragorn heaped more wood onto the fire. It was the only illumination within a nesting house, and the cluster of yellow flames was like a tiny candle within the huge, echoing space. Close to the fire, the glassy floor reflected the glow of the burning branches. It gleamed like a sheet of polished ice, and the blades of colour within often distracted Aragorn from his brooding. Aragorn ate no dinner. He was hungry, but he was too tense for food to sit well in his stomach, and in any case he felt that a meal would slow his thinking. Never was his mind so keen as when his belly was empty. He would not, he decided, eat again until he knew his true name, or until they had to leave the island, whichever came first. Several hours passed. They spoke little amongst themselves, although Aragorn remained conscious of the general drift of Saphira's moods and thoughts, even as she remained conscious of his. Then, as Aragorn was about to enter into his waking dreams, both to rest and out of hope that the dreams might provide some insight, Saphira uttered a yowl, reached forward with her right paw, and slapped it upon the floor. Several branches within the fire crumbled and fell apart, sending a burst of sparks toward the black ceiling. Alarmed, Aragorn sprang to his feet and drew Brisinger while he searched the darkness beyond the half-circle of stones for enemies. An instant later, he realized that Saphira's mood was not one of concern or anger, but of triumph.
"I have done it!" exclaimed Saphira. She arched her neck and loosed a jet of blue and yellow flame into the upper reaches of the building. "I know my true name!"
She spoke a single line in the ancient language, and the inside of Aragorn's mind seemed to ring with a sound like a bell, and for a moment the tips of Saphira's scales gleamed with an inner light, and she looked as if she were made of stars. The name was grand and majestic, but also tinged with sadness, for it named her as the last female of her kind. In the words, Aragorn could hear the love and devotion she felt for him, as well as all the other traits that made up her personality. Most he recognized, a few he did not. Her flaws were as prominent as her virtues, but overall, the impression was one of fire and beauty and grandeur. Saphira shivered from the tip of her nose to the tip of her tail, and she shuffled her wings.
"I know who I am,"
she said.
"Well done, Bjartskula,"
said Gleda, and Aragorn could sense how impressed he was.
"You have a name to be proud of. I would not say it again, however, not even to yourself. Until we are at the spire we have come to see, you must take great care to keep your name hidden now that you know it."
Saphira blinked and shuffled her wings again.
"Yes, master."
The excitement running through her was palpable. Aragorn sheathed Brisinger and walked over to her. She lowered her head until it was at his level. He stroked the line of her jaw and then pressed his forehead against her hard snout and held her as tightly as he could, her scales sharp against his fingers. Hot tears began to slide down his cheeks.
"Why do you cry?"
she asked. "Because I'm lucky enough to be bonded with you,
little one."
They talked for a while longer, as Saphira was eager to discuss what she had learned about herself. Aragorn was happy to listen, but he could not help feeling a little bitter that he still had not been able to divine his own true name. Then Saphira curled up on her side of the half-circle and went to sleep, leaving Aragorn to ruminate by the light of the dying campfire. Gleda remained awake and aware, and sometimes Aragorn consulted with him, but for the most part he kept to himself. The hours crawled past, and Aragorn grew increasingly frustrated. His time was running out. Ideally, he and Saphira should have left for the Varden the previous day. And yet, no matter what he tried, he seemed unable to describe himself as he was. It was nearly midnight, by his reckoning, when the rain ceased. Aragorn fidgeted, trying to make up his mind. Then he bounded to his feet, too wound up to bear sitting any longer. "I'm going for a walk," he said to Glaedha. He expected the dragon to object, but instead Glaedha said,
"Leave your weapons and armor here."
"Why?"
"Whatever you find, you need to face it by yourself. You cannot learn what you are made of if you rely on anyone or anything else to help you."
Glaedha's words made sense to Aragorn, but still he hesitated before he unbuckled his sword and dagger and pulled off his mail hauberk. He donned his boots and his damp cloak, and then he dragged the saddlebags that contained Glaedha's heart of hearts closer to Saphira. As Aragorn started to leave the half-circle of stones, Glaedha said,
"Do what you must, but be careful."
Outside the nesting house, Aragorn was pleased to see patches of stars and enough moonlight shining through the gaps in the clouds for him to make out his surroundings. He bounced on the balls of his feet a few times, wondering where to go. And then he set off at a brisk trot toward the heart of the ruined city. After a few seconds, his frustration got the better of him, and he increased his pace to an all-out run. As he listened to the sound of his breathing and of his footsteps pounding against the paving stones, he asked himself, "Who am I?" But no answer came to him. He ran until his lungs began to fail, and then he ran some more. And when neither his lungs nor his legs would sustain him any longer, he stopped by a weed-filled fountain and leaned on his arms against it while he recovered his breath. Around him loomed the shapes of several enormous buildings, shadowy hulks that looked like a range of ancient crumbling mountains. The fountain stood in the center of a vast square courtyard, much of which was littered with pieces of broken stone. He pushed himself off the fountain and slowly turned in a circle. In the distance, he could hear the deep, resonant croaking of the bullfrogs, an odd booming sound that grew especially loud whenever one of the larger frogs participated. A cracked slab of stone several yards away caught his eye. He walked over, grasped it by the edges, and with a heave, picked it off the ground. The muscles in his arms burning, he staggered to the edge of the courtyard and threw the slab onto the grass beyond. It landed with a soft but satisfying thump. He strode back to the fountain, unclasped his cloak, and draped it over the edge of the sculpture. Then he strode to the next piece of rubble, a jagged wedge that had cleaved off a larger block, and he fit his fingers underneath it and lifted it onto his shoulder. For over an hour, he labored to clear the courtyard. Some of the fallen masonry was so big he had to use magic to move it, but for the most part he was able to use his hands. He was methodical about it. He worked back and forth across the courtyard, and every piece of rubble he encountered, no matter how large or small, he stopped to remove. The effort soon left him drenched in sweat. He would have removed his tunic, but the edges of the stone were often sharp and would have cut him. As it was, he accumulated a host of bruises across his chest and shoulders, and he scraped his hands in numerous places. The exertion helped calm his mind, and since it required little thought, left him free to mull over all that he was and all that he might be. In the midst of his self-appointed task, as he was resting, after having shifted a particularly heavy length of cornice, he heard a threatening hiss, and he looked up to see a Snarlgly, this one with a shell at least 6 feet tall, gliding out of the darkness with startling speed. The creature's boneless neck was fully extended. Its lipless mouth was like a slash of darkness splitting its soft flesh, and its bulbous eyes were pointed directly at him. By the light of the moon, the Snarlgly's exposed flesh gleamed like silver, as did the track of slime it left behind. "Letter," said Aragorn, and he straightened upright and shook drops of blood from his torn hands.
Ono agnia treia eum verens mal edtha, o Snaldli.
As he spoke his warning, the snail slowed and retracted its eyes several inches. It paused when it was a few yards away, hissed again, and began to circle around to his left.
Oh, no, you don't,
he muttered, turning with it. He glanced over his shoulders to make sure no other Snaldli were approaching from behind. The giant snail seemed to realize that it could not catch him by surprise, for it stopped and sat hissing and waving its eyeballs at him.
You sound like a teapot left a boil, he said to it.
The Snaldli's eyeballs waved even faster, and then it charged at him, the edges of its flat belly undulating. Aragorn waited until the last moment, then jumped to the side and let the Snaldli slide past. He laughed and slapped the back of its shell.
Not too bright, are you?
Dancing away from it, he began to taunt the creature in the ancient language, calling it all sorts of insulting but perfectly accurate names. The snail seemed to puff up with rage. Its neck thickened and bulged, and it opened its mouth even farther and began to sputter as well as hiss. Again and again it charged at Aragorn, and every time he jumped out of the way. At last, the Snaldli grew tired of the game. It withdrew a half dozen yards and sat staring at him with its fist-sized eyeballs.
How do you ever catch anything when you're so slow?
Aragorn asked in a mocking tone, and he stuck his tongue out at the snail. The Snaldli hissed once more, and then it turned around and slid off into the darkness. Aragorn waited several minutes to be sure it was gone before he returned to clearing the rubble.
Maybe I should just call myself Snail Vanquisher, he muttered as he rolled a section of a pillar across the courtyard. Aragorn Shadeslayer, Vanquisher of Snails. I would strike fear into the hearts of men wherever I went.
It was the deepest part of the night when he finally dropped the last piece of stone onto the border of grass that edged the courtyard. There he stood, panting. He was cold and hungry and tired, and the scrapes on his hands and wrists smarted. He had ended by the northeastern corner of the courtyard. To the north was an immense hall that had been mostly destroyed during the battle. All that remained standing was a portion of the back walls and a single ivy-coloured pillar where the entryway had been. He stared at the pillar for the longest time. Above it, a cluster of stars, red, blue and white, shone through an opening in the clouds, gleaming like cut diamonds. He felt a strange attraction to them, as if their appearance signified something that he ought to be aware of. Without bothering to consider his action, he walked to the base of the pillar, scrambling over piles of rubble, then reached as high as he could and grasped the thickest part of the ivy, a stem as big around as his forearm and covered with thousands of tiny hairs. He tugged on the vine. It held, so he jumped off the ground and began to climb. Hand over hand, he scaled the pillar, which must have been 300 feet tall, but which felt taller the farther he got from the ground. He knew he was being reckless, but then he felt reckless. Halfway up, the smaller tendrils of vine began to peel off the stone when he put his full weight on them. After that, he was careful to only grab hold of the main stem and some of the thicker side branches. His grip had almost given out by the time he arrived at the top. The crown of the pillar was still intact. It formed a square, flat surface, large enough to sit on, with over a foot to spare on each side. Feeling somewhat shaky from the exertion, Aragorn crossed his legs and rested his hands palm upward on his knees, allowing the air to soothe his torn skin. Below him lay the ruined city, a maze of shattered husks that often echoed with strange, forlorn cries. In a few places where there were ponds, he could see the faint, glowing lights of the bullfrog's lures, like lanterns viewed from a great distance.
Angler frogs, he thought suddenly in the ancient language. That's what their name is, angler frogs. And he knew he was right, for the words seemed to fit like a key in a lock. Then he shifted his gaze to the cluster of stars that had inspired his climb.
He slowed his breathing and concentrated on maintaining a steady, never-ending flow of air in and out of his lungs. The cold, his hunger, and his trembling exhaustion gave him a peculiar sense of clarity. He seemed to float apart from his body, as if the bond between his consciousness and his flesh had grown attenuated, and there came upon him a heightened awareness of the city and the island around him. He was acutely sensitive to every motion of the wind and to every sound and smell that wafted past the top of the pillar. As he sat there, he thought of more names, and though none fully described him, his failures did not upset him, for the clarity he felt was too deep-seated for any setback to perturb his equanimity. "How can I include everything I am in just a few words?" he wondered, and he continued to ponder the question as the stars turned. Three warped shadows flew across the city like small, moving rifts in reality, and landed upon the roof of the building to his left. Then the dark, owl-shaped silhouettes spread their barbed plumes and stared at him with luminous, evil-looking eyes. The shadows chattered softly to one another, and two of them scratched their empty wings with claws that had no depth. The third held the remains of a bullfrog between its ebony talons. He watched the menacing birds for several minutes, and they watched him in return, and then they took flight and ghosted away to the west, making no more noise than a falling feather. Near dawn, when Aragorn could see the morning star between two peaks to the east, he asked himself, "What do I want?" Until then, he had not bothered to consider the question. He wanted to overthrow Galbatorix, that of course. But should they succeed, what then? Ever since he had left Palancar Valley, he had thought that he and Saphira would one day return, to live near the mountains he so loved. However, as he pondered the prospect, he slowly realized that it no longer appealed to him. He had grown up in Palancar Valley, and he would always consider it home. But what was left there for him or Saphira? Carvajal was destroyed, and even if the villagers rebuilt it some day, the town would never be the same. Besides, most of the friends he and Saphira had made lived elsewhere, and the two of them had obligations to the various races of Alagasia, obligations that they could not ignore. And after all the things they had done and seen, he could not imagine that either of them would be content to live in such an ordinary, isolated place. "For the sky is hollow, and the world is round. Even if they did return, what would they do? Raise cows and farm wheat?" He had no desire to eke out a living from the land as his family had during his childhood. He and Saphira were a rider and dragon. Their doom and their destiny was to fly at the forefront of history, not to sit before a fire and grow fat and lazy. And then there was Arya. If he and Saphira lived in Palancar Valley, he would see her rarely, if at all. "No," said Aragorn, and the word was like a hammer blow in the silence. "I don't want to go back." A cold tingle crawled down his spine. He had known he had changed since he, Brom, and Saphira had set out to track down the Razak, but he had clung to the belief that at his core he was still the same person. Now he understood that this was no longer true. The boy he had been when he first set foot outside of Palancar Valley had ceased to exist. Aragorn did not look like him, he did not act like him, and he no longer wanted the same things from life. He took a deep breath, and then released it in a long, shuddering sigh, as the truth sank into him. "I am not who I was." Saying it aloud seemed to give the thought weight. Then, as the first rays of dawn brightened the eastern sky over the ancient island of Roengard, where the riders and dragons had once lived, he thought of a name. A name such as he had not thought of before. And as he did, a sense of certainty came over him. He said the name
whispered it to himself in the deepest recesses of his mind, and all his body seemed to vibrate at once, as if Sapphira had struck the pillar beneath him. And then he gasped, and then he found himself both laughing and crying, laughing that he had succeeded, and for the sheer joy of comprehension, crying because all his failings, all the mistakes he had made, were now obvious to him. And he no longer had any delusions to comfort himself with. "I am not who I was," he whispered, gripping the edges of the column. "But I know who I am." The name, his true name, was weaker and more flawed than he would have liked, and he hated himself for that. But there was also much to admire within it, and the more he thought about it, the more he was able to accept the true nature of his self. He was not the best person in the world, but neither was he the worst. "And I won't give up," he growled. He took solace in the fact that his identity was not immutable. He could improve himself if he wished, and right then he swore to himself that he would do better in the future, be it ever so hard. Still laughing, still crying, he turned his face toward the sky and spread his arms out to either side. In time, the tears and the laughter stopped, and in their place he felt a sense of deep calm, overlaid with a tinge of happiness and resignation. Despite Glader's admonition, he again whispered his true name, and once more his entire being shook from the force of the words. Keeping his arms outstretched, he stood atop the pillar, and then he tipped forward and fell head first toward the ground. Just before he struck, he said, "Veiled," and he slowed, rotated, and alit upon the cracked stone as gently as if he was stepping out of a carriage. He returned to the fountain in the center of the courtyard and retrieved his cloak. Then, as light spread through the ruined city, he hurried back toward the nesting house, eager to wake Sapphira and tell her and Glader of his discovery.
The Vault of Souls. Aragorn lifted his sword and shield, eager to proceed, but also somewhat afraid. As before, he and Sapphira stood at the base of the Rock of Cuthien, while Glader's Heart of Hearts sat in the small chest hidden within the saddlebags upon Sapphira's back. It was still early morning, and the sun shone brightly through large tears in the canopy of clouds. Aragorn and Sapphira had wanted to go directly to the Rock of Cuthien once Aragorn had returned to the nesting house, but Glader had insisted that Aragorn eat first, and that they then wait for the food to settle in his stomach. But now they were finally at the jagged spire of stone, and Aragorn was tired of waiting, as was Sapphira. Ever since they had shared their true names, the bond between them seemed to have grown stronger, perhaps because they had both heard how much they cared for each other. It was something they had always known, but nevertheless, to have it stated in such irrefutable terms had increased the sense of closeness they shared. Somewhere to the north, a raven called.
"I'll go first," said Glader. "If it's a trap, I might be able to spring it before it catches either of you."
Aragorn started to pull his mind away from Glader, as did Sapphira, to allow the dragon to utter his true name without being overheard. But Glader said,
"No, you have told me your names. It is only right you should know mine."
Aragorn looked at Sapphira, and then they both said, "Thank you, Ebrithil." Then Glader spoke his name, and it boomed forth in Aragorn's mind like a fanfare of trumpets, regal and yet discordant, coloured throughout by Glader's grief and anger at Oromus's death. His name was longer than either Aragorn's or Sapphira's. It went on for several sentences, a record of a life that had stretched over centuries and which had contained joys and sorrows and accomplishments too numerous to count. His wisdom was evident in his name, but also contradictions, complexities that made it difficult to fully grasp his identity. Sephira felt the same sense of awe upon hearing Glader's name as did Aragorn. The sound of it made them both realize how young they still were, and how far they had to go before they could hope to match Glader's knowledge and experience. "I wonder what Arya's true name is," Aragorn thought to himself. They watched the Rock of Cuthien intently, but saw no change. Sephira went next, arching her neck and pawing at the ground like a high-spirited charger. She proudly stated her true name. Even in the daylight, her scales again shimmered and sparkled at the proclamation. Hearing her and Glader say their true names made Aragorn less self-conscious about his own. None of them were perfect, and yet they did not condemn each other for their shortcomings, but rather acknowledged and forgave them. Again, nothing happened after Sephira uttered her name. Lastly, Aragorn stepped forward. A cold sweat coated his brow. Knowing that it might be his final act as a free man, he spoke his name with his mind, as had Glader and Sephira. They had agreed beforehand that it would be safer for him to avoid saying his name out loud, so as to reduce the chance that anyone might overhear it. As Aragorn formed the last word with his thoughts, a thin, dark line appeared at the base of the spire. It ran upward 50 feet, and then split in two and arched down to either side, tracing the outline of 2 broad doors. Upon the doors appeared row after row of glyphs limned in gold, wards against both physical and magical detection. Once the outline was complete, the doors swung outward upon hidden hinges, scraping aside the dirt and plants that had accumulated before the spire since the doors had last opened, whenever that had been. Through the doorway was a huge vaulted tunnel that descended at a steep angle into the bowels of the earth. The doors ground to a halt, and the clearing fell silent again. Aragorn stared at the dark tunnel, feeling a sense of increasing apprehension. They had found what they were looking for, but he still was not sure if it was a trap or not.
"Solemnbum did not lie," said Sephira.
Her tongue darted out as she tasted the air.
"Yes, but what's waiting for us inside?" asked Aragorn.
"This place should not exist," said Glader. "We and the riders hid many secrets on Vroengard, but the island is too small for a tunnel as large as this to have been built without others knowing. And yet I have never heard of it before."
Aragorn frowned and glanced about. They were still alone. No one was trying to sneak up on them. Could it have been built before the riders made Vroengard their home? Glader thought for a moment.
"I do not know. Perhaps. It is the only explanation that makes sense. But if so, then it is ancient indeed."
The three of them searched the passageway with their minds, but they felt no living thing within it.
"Right then," said Aragorn.
The sour taste of dread filled his mouth, and his palms were slick within his gloves. Whatever they were about to find at the other end of the tunnel, he wanted to know once and for all. Sephira was also nervous, but less than he.
"Let us dig out the rat hiding in this nest," she said.
Together, then, they walked through the doorway and into the tunnel. As the last inch of Sephira's tail slid over the threshold, the doors swung shut behind them and closed with a loud crack of stone meeting stone, plunging them into darkness.
"Oh, no, no, no!" growled Aragorn, rushing back to the doors. "Neina Havitr," he said, and a directionless white light illuminated the entrance to the tunnel. The inner surfaces of the doors were perfectly smooth, and no matter how he pushed and pounded on them, they refused to budge.
"Blast it!"
We should have used a log or a boulder to wedge them open, he lamented, berating himself for not thinking of it beforehand.
If we have to, we can always break them down, said Saphira. That I very much doubt, said Glader.
Aragon regripped Brisinger. Then I guess we have no choice but to go forward.
When have we ever had any choice but to go forward?
Asked Saphira. Aragon altered his spell so that the weir light emanated from a single point near the ceiling. Otherwise the lack of shadows made it difficult for him and Saphira to judge depth. And then, together, they started down the slanting tunnel. The floor of the passageway was somewhat knobbly, which made it easy for them to maintain their footing in the absence of steps. Where the floor and the walls met, they flowed together as if the stone had been melted, which told Aragon that it was most likely elves who had excavated the tunnel. Down they went, deeper and deeper into the earth, until Aragon guessed they had passed under the foothills behind the Rock of Cuthien and burrowed into the roots of the mountain beyond. The tunnel neither turned nor branched, and the walls remained utterly bare. At last Aragon felt a hint of warm air rising toward them from farther down the tunnel, and he noticed a faint orange glow in the distance. Letter, he murmured, and extinguished the weir light. The air continued to warm as they descended, and the glow before them waxed in brightness. Soon they were able to see an end to the tunnel, a huge black arch that was covered entirely with sculpted glyphs, which made the arch look as if it were wrapped in thorns. The smell of brimstone tainted the air, and Aragon felt his eyes begin to water. They stopped before the archway. Through it, all they could see was a flat, grey floor. Aragon glanced back the way they had come, then returned his gaze to the arch. The jagged structure made him nervous, and Saphira as well. He tried to read the glyphs, but they were too jumbled and too densely packed to make sense of, nor could he detect any energy stored within the black structure. Yet he had difficulty believing that it was not enchanted. Whoever built the tunnel had succeeded in hiding the latch spell for the doors to the outside, which meant they could have done the same with any spells they had placed upon the arch. He exchanged a quick look with Saphira, and he wet his lips as he remembered what Glader had said.
There are no more safe paths.
Saphira snorted, releasing a small jet of flame from the pit of each nostril. And then, as one, she and Aragon walked through the archway. Lacuna, Part the First. Aragon noticed several things at once. First, that they were standing at one side of a circular chamber over 200 feet across, with a large pit in the centre, from which radiated a dull orange glow. Second, that the air was stiflingly hot. Third, that around the outer part of the room were two concentric rings of bench-like tiers, the back one higher than the front, upon which rested numerous dark objects. Fourth, that the wall behind this tier sparkled in numerous places, as if decorated with coloured crystal. But he had no opportunity to examine either the wall or the dark objects, for in the open area next to the glowing pit, there stood a man with the head of a dragon. The man was made of metal, and he gleamed like polished steel. He wore no clothes other than a segmented loincloth fashioned out of the same lustrous material as his body, and his chest and limbs rippled with muscles like those of a cull. In his left hand he held a metal shield, and in his right an iridescent sword that Aragon recognized as the blade of a rider. Behind the man, set within the far side of the room, Aragon vaguely saw a throne, with the outline of the creature's body worn into its back and seat. The dragon-headed man strode forward. His skin and joints moved as smoothly as flesh, but every step sounded as if a great weight was being dropped onto the floor. He stopped 30 feet from Aragon and Saphira, and stared at them with eyes that flickered like a pair of crimson flames. Then, lifting his scaled head, he uttered a peculiar metallic roar that echoed until it seemed as if a dozen creatures were bellowing at them. Even as Aragorn was wondering whether they were supposed to fight the creature, he felt a strange, vast mind touch his. The consciousness was unlike any he had encountered before, and it seemed to contain a host of shouting voices, a great disjointed chorus that reminded him of the wind inside a storm. Before he could react, the mind stabbed through his defenses and seized control of his thoughts. For all the time he had spent practicing with Glaeda, Arya and Saphira, he could not stop the attack. He could not even slow it. He might as well have tried to hold back the tide with his bare hands. A blur of light and a roar of incoherent noise surrounded him as the yammering chorus forced itself into every nook and cranny of his being. Then it felt as if the invader tore his mind into a half dozen pieces, each of which remained aware of the others, but none of which was free to do as it wished, and his vision fragmented, as if he were seeing the chamber through the facets of a jewel. 6 different memories began to race through his fractured consciousness. He had not chosen to recall them, they simply appeared, and they flew past faster than he could follow. At the same time, his body bent and flexed in various poses, and then his arm lifted Brisinger to where his eyes could see, and he beheld 6 identical versions of the sword. The invader even had him cast a spell, the purpose of which he did not and could not understand, for the only thoughts he had were those the other allowed. Nor did he feel any emotion, but that of fading alarm. For what seemed like hours, the alien mind examined every one of his memories, from the moment he had set out from his family's farm to hunt deer in the spine, 3 days before he had found Saphira's egg, up until the present. In the back of his mind, Aragorn could sense the same thing happening to Saphira, but the knowledge meant nothing to him. At last, long after he would have given up hope of release if he still had command of his thoughts, the whirling chorus carefully rejoined the pieces of his mind, and then withdrew. Aragorn staggered forward and dropped to one knee before he was able to regain his balance. Beside him, Saphira lurched and snapped at the air. How? He thought. Who? To capture both of them at once, and Glaeda as well, he assumed, was something he did not believe even Galbatorix was capable of. Again, the consciousness pressed against Aragorn's mind, but this time it did not attack. This time it said,
"Our apologies, Saphira. Our apologies, Aragorn. But we had to be certain of your intentions. Welcome to the Vault of Souls. Long have we waited for you, and welcome to you as well, cousin. We are glad that you are still alive. Take now your memories, and know that your task is at long last complete."
A bolt of energy flashed between Glaeda and the consciousness. An instant later, Glaeda uttered a mental bellow that made Aragorn's temples throb with pain. A surge of jumbled emotions rushed forth from the golden dragon: sorrow, triumph, disbelief, regret. And overriding them all, a sense of joyous relief so intense, Aragorn found himself smiling, without knowing why. And brushing against Glaeda's mind, he felt not just one strange mind, but a multitude, all whispering and murmuring. "Who?" whispered Aragorn. Before them, the man with the head of a dragon had not shifted so much as an inch.
"Aragorn," said Saphira, "look at the wall, look."
He looked, and he saw that the circular wall was not decorated with crystal as he had first taken it to be. Rather, dozens upon dozens of alcoves dotted the wall, and within each alcove rested a glittering orb. Some were large, some were small, but they all pulsed with a soft inner glow, like coals smouldering in a dying campfire. Aragorn's heart skipped a beat as comprehension dawned upon him. He lowered his gaze to the dark objects on the tiers below. They were smooth and ovoid, and appeared to have been sculpted from stone of differing colours. As with the orbs, some were large and some were small. But regardless of their size, their shape was one he would have recognised anywhere. A hot flush crept over him, and his knees grew weak. It cannot be! He wanted to believe what he saw, but he feared that it might be an illusion created to prey on his hopes. And yet the possibility that what he beheld was actually there took his breath away and left him staggered and overwhelmed to such a degree that he knew not what to do or say. Zafira's reaction was much the same, if not stronger. Then the mind spoke again.
You are not mistaken, hatchlings, nor do your eyes deceive you. We are the secret hope of our race. Here lie our hearts of hearts, the last free Eldunari in the land. And here lie the eggs that we have guarded for over a century.